Well, welcome to the netzpolitik.org podcast. My name is Markus Beckedahl, and my guest today is Lawrence Liang from Bangalore. He is a researcher with the Alternative Law Forum. What is the Alternative Law Forum?
We are a group of lawyers and other practitioners, and we work on different kind of human rights issues, etc. We also have a research component in our work, and I'm a part of the research team, and I work primarily on intellectual property laws.
What is your main focus on intellectual property?
I work on piracy and informal economies in knowledge and culture.
What is piracy in developing countries?
Usually there's a very negative opinion of piracy, where piracy is seen to be kind of, you know, the commercial exploitation of kind of copyrighted works, for example, selling cheap DVDs, photocopying books, etc. And we have been working towards the argument that piracy is not only a positive thing, but actually necessary in developing countries, where there is a sharp gap or a divide between the, in some senses, you know, people who have access to knowledge and cultural commodities and those who can't afford it. And in many ways, piracy is, you know, what enables a large number of people to participate in the terms of knowledge and culture, which they would otherwise be excluded from.
Is this bad for our economy?
The argument generally is that it's bad for the economy because, you know, companies lose money and the state loses large revenues because of taxation. But the fact of the matter is that it's very often based on extremely faulty kind of assumptions, economic assumptions. The main one being that every pirated commodity is a lost sale, which is never true, because the person would never have bought it if there wasn't a pirate copy. And also it depends on which perspective you look at the question of economy from. For example, the entire domain of piracy actually creates very local, very, very vibrant local economies. It creates employment, it enables transfer of technology, it allows for local innovations to emerge. So if you're looking at it from the perspective of a global information economy, where you're a multinational that controls, let's say, the rights to a film or music, etc., then yes, it is bad for the economy. But if you're interested in the development of local economies as well as promoting local innovation, I would say it's good for the economy. There's also a very complicated relationship between piracy and the creation of markets, because very often we have seen that in sectors like music or software, etc., it's really the emergence of piracy or the existence of piracy that allows for the creation of a market. If you take a product like Microsoft Windows, you know, it's really the informal networks that helped create a market for Windows, and it was pirated for many years, and Windows, you know, Microsoft never did anything about it. Till such time that the market was actually established. And there is a lot of empirical work done on this in different, in film cultures and music cultures, looking at the very kind of vibrant cultural economy that has emerged because of the infrastructure set up by piracy.
Can you give some concrete examples of local economies, how it works?
Sure. If you take the case of the music industry, for a very long time, from, in fact, 1908 till around the 70s, the music scene in India was dominated by one company, HMB, which was set up with the help of course, the Crown. And they controlled something like 92% of the music market in India. And there are very serious cultural implications of that, because when you have a national monopoly, then the kind of aesthetic that you create is also a national aesthetic. So you tend to promote those kind of, you know, cultural expressions that have a national wide market. So you have the emergence, for example, of the Hindi film song as the sole or dominant aesthetic at the cost of local languages and other kinds of genres. In the 70s, with the emergence of cassette technology, you had the emergence of a small number of, you know, pirate record companies, music companies, who started basically a mixture of both legal and, illegal manufacturing, where they would, for example, pirate a number of the latest HMV releases for a low cost and sell it at a lower price. But at the same time, they were also catering to smaller markets because they didn't have to meet the economies of scale which HMV required because, you know, they were not so large. And they started catering to local genres and started promoting different kinds of languages, etc. In a period of around 8 years, the monopoly of HMV fell from 92% to something like 40%. And the proliferation of music cultures apart from Hindi and apart from the film song became massive. So you had genres in India, you know, you have these genres called Qawwali, Rasiya, Birha, all of which grew because of this thing. And this is really one instance where, you know, you had a very vibrant music culture which is actually enriched by piracy rather than depleted by piracy.
And how does it work at the local level? So we are living in a developed country, so we have our big supermarkets selling music and stuff like that. How does it work in India?
It works at one level in a similar way, where you also have the high-end music store, but you also have the neighborhood store kind of thing where, you know, for example, one of the innovations that one of the companies, T-Series, did was to change the rules of distribution. They moved away from the music store into the grocery store. So they moved very literally into neighborhoods and started distributing through informal channels. So you didn't have to, you know, you didn't have to spend that kind of money on the setting up of distribution networks or setting up, you know, kind of shops very literally. You started relying in some senses on an existing infrastructure of distribution. And it converted the music, you know, kind of cassette from, in some senses, the elite commodity into the mass commodity. So it's a very interesting scenario that's happening right now, where a large number of the media production, the pirate media production in cities like Delhi, take place completely in the domain of the informal economy, right? So it's almost like a household production, a small-scale industry, where a large number of settlements and colonies, which would be considered rather, you know, kind of poor and lacking in urban infrastructure, have also now at the same time become the hub for media production.
And where does the term piracy comes from? So in the history?
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting that they've used the phrase piracy, which comes, of course, from maritime piracy in the context of, in illegal information goods. But I think it's interesting in terms of the link, the historical link between the idea of piracy and what is happening in the domain of information. Because the first pirates, of course, were the people who, you know, kind of the slaves and the indentured labor who were taken on the ships after being expropriated from the commons. You know, so when the first enclosures movement happened, and people were taken away from the lands and made into slave labor or into wage labor, the system was essential for a period of capitalism, an early period of capitalism, which demanded, you know, kind of the movement of goods and commodities across the seas. And the pirates were the ones who disobeyed or broke free from the kind of rules of property that were being imposed on them and created a new order of the redistribution of wealth. So this was met with great kind of, you know, legal violence, where piracy was declared to be the first kind of act crime against humanity in many ways. So at a time when you have the emergence of the idea of national sovereignty and nation states, piracy was that which transcended the limitations of the nation. So you had a principle called the hostile humani generis, which is the declaration of someone being an enemy of mankind, and that was the pirate. So if you were to look at the contemporary, with the era of globalization, where, you know, capital and information flows across nation states, and in a way that, you know, intangible property really is the property of the contemporary, there is a similar requirement to contain the leakages or the kind of leak that happens in these information highways, where the media commodity has to be disciplined through the rigors of time and through the rigors of space for it to maximize returns. And piracy is now seen as that which disrupts the flow of the media commodity and the flow of global information capitalism.
In the field of intellectual property, is piracy a new thing?
Not at all. I mean, the field of intellectual property was actually born from piracy.
Why?
If you take the first copyright legislation, the Statute of Anne, which came in 1706, it was the case of the print technology or you know, the great print revolution, where all of a sudden the book, which was earlier a very valuable commodity because it had to be produced by hundreds of people copying literally one copy after the other. With the print technology, with the emergence of print technology, when all of a sudden knowledge became democratized, you had the emergence of a large number of pirates who were reproducing books and making them available to a new reading public sphere. And the first kind of case in England, for example, dealt with the Scottish pirates reprinting books that they were not authorized to do. And while the entire battle took place in the name of the author, there was no author involved in the battle. It was a battle between the publishers, who had been given a monopoly by the crown, and Scottish pirates, you know, who were reproducing it for another public altogether.
And what about Hollywood?
Hollywood, again, is a creature of piracy. So if you look at the early kind of battles that took place, it's incredible because the battle was between, you know, the owners of technologies for the production and creation of cinema, people like Thomas Edison, and the various mavericks who were stealing this technology and creating films. And literally, in a sense, Hollywood, which is located in the West Coast and in California, was created because of the migration of the pirates from, you know, the East Coast and from New York to the West as a result of kind of, you know, police action that was being taken against them by the owners of cinema technology. So if you look at the early history of cinema, I mean, one of the most famous films in silent cinema is a film about the gardener who looks at a hose and thinks that there is no water because a little boy is stepping on the hose, only to be, you know, kind of have his face wet when the little boy takes his leg out of the pipe. Very famous. And there are 16 versions of this film, and no one is able to trace what the origin of this film is. So, you know, in a sense, copying was intrinsic to the emergence of movie culture itself. Yeah.
And what about Bollywood?
Bollywood has been very famously accused of not having created any original films, right? And the moment there is a Hollywood film which is a hit, it will be remade in Bollywood, etc., right? All of these are very famous kind of stories. And I think that, you know, again, it shows in many ways how intrinsic the act of copying is to the entire world of cultural production itself. There are all kinds of inspirations, etc., for Bollywood films. But there is also a cyclical, so I don't see it as a one-way mode where, you know, the copy kind of, you know, takes away from the original or copies from the original. I like to think of, you know, a term other than original and copy. So we have been working, for example, with the idea of a recension. A recension is something which is neither an original nor a copy. An example of this in Indian culture, of course, are the two great epics, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, which emerge through acts of retelling. So a recension is something that adds value. The copying process adds value rather than takes away. So if a film like Seven Samurais is remade into The Magnificent Seven, remade into a Hindi film called Satte Pe Satta, it's something that adds value to the original and doesn't take away from it. So Bollywood, I think, has, in that sense, added to global culture by copying from it.
When you take a look back to the G8 summit in Heiligendamm, the G8 had a declaration where they wrote strong IP is the best way for innovation, and only strong IP.
Right.
From your view, from a developing country, do you agree?
Not just from a developing country, but I think from the perspective of developing and developed countries, I think strong IP is a deterrent against innovation. And it's actually thin IP or low IP that has been a promoter of innovation. And this is particularly true when you take areas like software, where innovation in software is not like rocket science, where it's a breakthrough innovation. Innovation in software is incremental, and it is built on minor innovations rather than major innovations. So if you were to take the fact that, the number of patents that are granted to software on a yearly basis would actually make the creation or production of software an economically unviable act. If you take the simple home DVD player, there are more than 5,700 patents that are granted on every single DVD player, right? So you can imagine that if someone wanted to even create something which was an innovation on the DVD player, the first thing that they would have to do is to ensure that they're not violating someone's patent. Otherwise, after all that work, it would be, kind of a complete waste for them. And if you take a fact that an average royalty payment on a patent is 5%, it basically means that, if you're even close to the patent of, let's say, 20 people, then you can't do anything, because it's 100% of your thing would be in royalty payment. And 100%, of course, is not what it takes to create a business model. The maximum that one could even be able to spend on royalty payments would be something like 10% of your budget. So the risk that you run, therefore, is that if you even violate two patents, then you can't actually produce anything. Now that, for me, is a debtor on innovation and not a promotion on innovation.
And how is the development of IP in India?
For a long time, India was a pirate nation, and it did a whole lot of good for the global public. And the best example of this is the medicine sector. Because from 1970, where India's patent laws refused to grant what is known as a product patent for pharmaceuticals, and the Indian drug companies imported a large number of drugs from Europe and the US and reverse engineered it and created cheap generic versions, which have saved the lives of millions of people, especially in the sector of HIV/AIDS, where before the Indian generic companies produced what is known as a cocktail pill, the average cost of HIV treatment was something like $12,000 a year. Now, how many people can afford treatment at that rate? The Indian companies brought out a version that came to $300 a year. The difference between $300 and $12,000 is a large number of lives. From the time that India signed the TRIPS agreement and became a part of the WTO, we were given 10 years to make our laws compatible with the TRIPS agreement. And from 2005, the Indian laws have been compatible with the TRIPS agreement, which means, for example, in the case of patent law, we now recognize pharmaceutical patents. And there are ongoing battles in India right now on drugs which have become unaffordable because product patent has been granted on them and no one else can make them. A drug in particular which is being battled on right now is Glivec, which is an anti-cancer drug whose price has risen 10 times since 2005 because the product patent exists on it.
What will be the future of India and IP?
It is a difficult question to answer because a large number of developing countries, particularly the slightly powerful ones like Brazil, China, South Africa, India, etc., are under heavy pressure from the US with the risk of trade sanctions being imposed on them if they do not have stricter IP enforcement. Every year there is a threat of India being put on the special 301 list. So there is a lot of pressure on India to change its IP laws. At the same time, the national elite in India have also bought into this line that India can have, greater economic growth with greater intellectual property law. So the assumption is that India will also enter the knowledge economy as net exporters rather than net importers of IP. So this confluence of kind of the global, you know, the interests of the global elite and the national elite is producing a very, very kind of dangerous situation where India will start having stricter IP laws and start enforcing stricter IP laws, which could be extremely detrimental to a large number of the people living in India.
Are there Creative Commons licenses available in India?
Yes. Creative Commons launched in India in January 2007. And the hope is that it'll be used by, let's say, the educational institutions and the development sector, in addition to creators working in the field of culture.
How many people use computers in India?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure of the exact number, but one of the interesting things to think of the computer is that when you think of the computer in the West, you often think of the personal computer. But if you think of the computer in India, like a number of other public goods, there is a strong culture of the shared computer, particularly in the form of the cyber cafe, where there are a large number of cyber cafes that have mushroomed all over small towns and large cities all across India. So very often people speak of the digital divide and the technological divide. While it is a true statement, it is also, while it's a true and accurate statement, it's also not a very, explanatory statement, or doesn't really explain too much. Because very often when I have been in Europe, I have found it extremely difficult to access the internet unless you had, a connection in the hotel. Because there are no public spaces, there are not too many public spaces where you can access it. Whereas in India, I don't think you can walk for more than 50 meters without encountering a public cyber cafe. So, while the penetration of computers at the level of individual PCs or laptops may be much lower, I think that with the culture of public access, it would be safe to say that, the computer has become kind of almost a very standardized or available, kind of tool.
Is there still the Simputer project in India?
The Simputer project has unfortunately not really taken off. There was a lot of excitement around the Simputer project when it had begun, but it has kind of failed to meet its promise, mainly because of the failure of manufacturing. I think one of the problems with the Simputer project, Simputer project was also a certain limitation by the imagination of a nationalist product. They wanted the product to be an Indian product. But India has never been very strong on electronic manufacturing. And it might have actually made a lot more sense, for example, to import the body from a country like Taiwan. And I think this is where it got stuck. And now, of course, by the time they were even ready to produce the Simputer, a number of other commercial companies had come up with kind of equally cheap and more technologically savvy handheld devices.
Will India buy the old PC instead of Simputers for the
school? I don't know if I agree with the larger premise of the OLPC project. The question of education is plagued by a whole range of other problems, including the absence of very basic infrastructure, the absence of high-quality teachers, etc. And the technological determinism that underwrites a project like the OLPC is what I am a little, nervous about. The assumption that the giving of a computer to every child will actually solve the problem of education, and I'm not too sure I endorse it. I reserve my judgment on it, and I hope that it succeeds, but I think that there are also other questions to be addressed, apart from the grant of a computer to every child.
Okay, thank you for the interview.
You're welcome, my pleasure.